Next, I want to go to an important point that Lenin raised when he spoke about imperialism and the split in socialism, or the split in the proletariat. And this relates in important ways to a formulation that I've discussed before, for example, in what was reprinted as The Basis, the Goals, and the Methods of the Communist Revolution, namely the separation of the communist movement from the labor movement. Now, if you think about all the things that have been said here with the concepts of reification and discussion of determinism, economic determinism in particular, economism, identifying the size of the enterprise as a determinant of how class conscious people are, and all those kinds of concepts, and how they don't lead where we need to go, you can get an understanding of why I speak about the importance of the separation of the communist movement from the labor movement. As I emphasize in The Basis, the Goals, and the Methods of the Communist Revolution, this does not mean, and must not mean, the separation of the communist movement from the proletariat or from materialism, quite the contrary. But it's speaking to the need for the communist movement, to put it in simple and direct terms, for the communist movement to be a revolutionary movement and not a labor movement, which has been a very strong tendency in the history of the international communist movement, and also those who've been opposed to communism but have spoken in the name of socialism, such as the Trotskyites and various reformist socialists and so on. We need a revolutionary movement aiming to achieve the four alls, aiming for communism, not a labor movement aiming for a fair day's wage, for a fair day's work in one form or another. We need a movement that aims for thoroughgoing emancipation and the abolition of everything that stands in the way of that emancipation, of all and not half or a part of humanity. That's what's meant by the separation of the communist movement from the labor movement. Doesn't mean we would never relate to the struggles, waged by workers in relationship to their employers or things like that, but we would relate to them from a communist standpoint and with communist objectives, not from a trade unionist standpoint and from the point of view of not seeing beyond the confines of a labor movement whose very definition is to try to get a better wage for a day's work, in essence. And another important dimension to this is you can see the interrelation of this whole concept and perspective and approach of the separation of the communist movement from the labor movement in its interrelation to the skewing of class relations and of the consciousness and class consciousness in particular by the historical role of national oppression and white supremacy, beginning with slavery and continuing to the present day throughout the history of the U.S. In the talk, Why We're in the Situation We're in Today and What to Do About a Thoroughly Rotten System and the Need for Revolution, I spoke to this skewing, citing some discussion of this by Edmund S. Morgan. And I spoke to it from another angle in the talk, Communism and Jeffersonian Democracy. There was a way in which, as Morgan pointed out, from the very foundation and from the very beginning of the country, by treating a certain group of people or groups of people, in particular African slaves, mulattoes, and Indians, as a pariah group or a pariah class, there could be reinforced the notion of the identity of another group of people, i.e. the white population, even with all the very pronounced class differences and even antagonisms among that group of white people. And a perspective of simply building a labor movement cannot encompass those contradictions and the need to overcome the effects of those contradictions, to build a revolutionary movement which mobilizes all positive factors from all sections of the proletariat, basing itself in fundamental terms on the lower, deeper section of the proletariat of all nationalities. We're never going to deal with the peculiarities and particularities of how class relations and class consciousness has been skewed in the history of this country, other than coming at it from the most sweeping view of getting to communism. once again standing on the mountaintop and looking with the quote-unquote godlike position of the proletariat, all these different contradictions, their motion and development and their interconnection, and pointing everyone toward the achievement of the four alls and struggling to raise people's sights to that, and not for anything less than that in any form. Revenge, reform, and so on, which will only mean the perpetuation of all the horrors that life in this system actually involve for huge numbers of people in this society and for the overwhelming majority of humanity, in terms, once again, which are very difficult even to adequately describe. On the other side of this, so to speak, but an important element of this, is the fact that as important as national oppression and white supremacy has been, and as much as it remains an integral and foundational part of the whole history of this country, and is institutionalized and structured into the very edifice, the very structure, and the very functioning of this society, and remains so down to today, our outlook, and the outlook which we have to struggle with masses of people of whatever nationality to take up, has to be not nationalism, but internationalism. Not nationalism, even of the most revolutionary or radical kind, but communism. Because only in being guided by that outlook, and only as that outlook increasingly leads and sets the terms for the struggle, can all forms of oppression, including white supremacy and oppression of whole nations and people, be finally overcome. That's one of the ironies, perhaps, that people who are very determined nationalists and may play an important role up to a point in the struggle, not only against national oppression, but other forms of oppression, cannot see far enough and cannot therefore lead even to the abolition of the national oppression of the oppressed people of which they are a part. Nationalism is too narrow a framework from which to understand and therefore from which to transform all these relations of oppression. Nationalism doesn't enable you to understand, for example, what I was saying earlier about how the oppression of women is central to the whole character and dynamics of class society in various forms, including capitalist society, how it is completely bound up with and interconnected with the division of society into antagonistic classes, exploiters and exploited, oppressors and oppressed, and how all the different forms of those social relations that Marx spoke about in the Four Alls are all interconnected and interwoven, and that you can't abolish any of these pillars of oppression without abolishing them all. A nationalist outlook does not enable you to see all that. It doesn't get high enough on the mountaintop. It goes a part of the way up, but it's blocked by the bigger structures of the mountain that are still there. You have to get up higher than that to be able to see the whole view of all of this and how it all fits together and where it all came from and where it can all be led to, in order to get to someplace radically different and better. So here's another contradiction. There will never be a revolution in any country, and in particular, this is acutely so in the U.S., without a determined struggle, not only on the part of those who are directly oppressed by white supremacy and national oppression, but on the part of the proletariat and the masses of people as a whole to take on and finally uproot this national oppression as a key part of the overall revolution and the overall advance to communism. There will never be emancipation without that. There will never be even the first step of making, or the first great leap of seizing power, without that being a crucial part to be taken up by the proletariat, particularly its advanced vanguard section, but also leading the broader masses to take up the fight against national oppression, just as there will never be even the first great leap without taking up in a determined, systematic, and all-around way the oppression of women. But only from the standpoint of a communist viewpoint and method, only from standing in that place on the mountaintop, Can you see how all of these things fit together and the interconnection of them, and how uprooting any of them is interconnected with and interdependent on uprooting all of them? So on the one hand, our revolution has a crucial part of that revolution is taking on and struggling against and moving to abolish white supremacy and national oppression and male supremacy and the oppression of women. But it cannot be led by nationalism or by feminism. It can only be led with a communist viewpoint that sees the broad sweep of things, the dynamics that are driving and underlying all this, and the interconnection of all these diverse factors, and how a synthesis can be achieved that leads to the abolition of all those things, that leads to the abolition of those four alls, or the transformation and revolutionization of society in accordance with those, with transforming those four alls. So what this gets back to again is that we have to bring forward people who are emancipators of humanity, fighters to end all forms of oppression, not some, not they had their turn, let me have a go, it's my turn now, not let's change society so a man can have his rightful place and put women in theirs, but a revolution to do away with all these forms of oppression, to emancipate all of humanity in the fullest sense, to move beyond all the production relations, all the social relations, all the political institutions, structures and processes, and all the customs, habits, traditions, and ideas that mutually reinforce relations of exploitation and oppression, and work to reestablish them even where they've been abolished temporarily. Nationalism will not get us there, and revenge will not get us there. Me and my people, or me and my identity group, will not get us there. They will only lead us back to where we already are, and lead people to be even more demoralized in the process for having tried to do something and ending up in failure and defeat. So if we understand it's not about a narrow concept where, you know, as the Bible puts it, the first shall be last and the last shall be first. But it's about the emancipation of all humanity. Then we see more of how we can handle, first of all, we recognize more fully the complexity of all this, but then we recognize more fully how we can, to use that phrase again, work and struggle our way through this complexity toward this goal. We can see how the narrow concept of just having a workers' republic run by workers' councils, for example, is way too narrow a concept and can't get beyond bourgeois right, can't get beyond commodity production and exchange, can't ultimately get beyond relations of master and slave in many different forms, of exploiter and exploited. There's a much broader and much richer tapestry, if you will, or panoply of diverse social and class forces that you have to interrelate with, and you have to lead all in an overall common direction without trying to force it all into single file, going all step by step in formation together and in uniformity. That's another contradiction we have to handle. That's why, again, repeatedly brought up this point about going right to the brink of being drawn and quartered without actually having it happen. You have to have not only a big heart in the sense of having a broad outlook, you also have to have big arms, metaphorically speaking, very broad arms to encompass all of this and to keep it all going forward without squeezing the life out of it and forcing it into some kind of artificial uniformity which cannot exist and will not last. And this is related to something else that I brought up in the basis, the methods, and the goals of the Communist Revolution, which I called the parachute point. Now, what I'm referring to here is that when you do get to the threshold, the immediate doorway of a revolution, when all of the contradictions do become concentrated and accentuated in society in such a way that it opens the possibility of wrenching a revolution out of all this, then in a certain way, it's like a parachute closing up. Or you could think of an umbrella, the same thing, closing up. Parachute closes up. Things compress in and around the one force in society, which is the vanguard of the one class in society, broadly speaking, the proletariat, that actually has a way out of all of this. And when you get a revolution or a revolutionary situation, one of the signs of that, one of the ways that you can tell that's developing or that you're on a threshold, is that all the other forces of opposition, with their different viewpoints and programs, have in significant ways been tried out and been shown to be lacking. Not only in some broad historical sense, but in the immediate sense that they don't deal with needs and demands that are immediately and acutely felt by masses of people and around which masses of people, speaking in millions and tens of millions in a country like this, around which those masses of people are prepared and determined to fight and are looking for leadership with which to fight around those things. If you look at the Russian Revolution, what was the slogan of the Russian Revolution when it was actually made? It was land, bread, and peace. Only the Bolsheviks had a program that could implement what was captured in those slogans. Get out of that imperialist war. No other force, including among the so-called socialists, was willing to get out of the imperialist war. They all rationalized why they had to continue fighting. They were fighting for the democratic side or for the fatherland or however they put it. No other force had both the orientation and the program of actually distributing land among the peasantry. That was the land part. And no other force had a program for actually being able to meet the needs of the people on a very basic level, like eating, having bread, which the masses did not have as the war and the way in which the war stretched and tortured the fabric of society and wore down the resources of society. The mass of people in Russia didn't even have bread to eat. And those things, land, bread, and peace, became the rallying cry for millions and tens of millions of people to come to the banner of the Bolsheviks, not because they said those three words, but because the masses recognized through the swirl of events and the struggle over different programs that every other force either wouldn't or couldn't fight for those things in a way that would really bring in about the kind of change that was felt as acutely and immediately necessary by tens of millions of people. So therefore, things became compressed around the Bolsheviks. It's not like, as I said at the beginning of this talk, everybody suddenly gave up on the idea of revenge or that they wanted to have their rightful place or all these other notions, and everybody became instantly a communist in the fullest possible sense. Most of the people who followed the communists, the Bolsheviks, were not communists. They were obviously not antagonistic to the communists, not deeply opposed to them, but most of them had a complex combination of different views and different objectives. It was a mixed bag of a lot of different things motivating them, but they became tightened up around the communists, if you will, compressed in around the communist program, because only the communists had in immediate terms, had a way out of things that masses of people urgently and acutely demanded. Not things they said, oh, that would be nice, but things they said, we can't live without these things. We are not willing to go on another day without these things. The communists had the answer to that, and nobody else did. To put it another way, in a certain sense, in this revolutionary situation in Russia, and this will characterize any revolution as it gets to the final phase of actually going all out for power in the society as a whole, the entire communist program in its larger dimension, as represented by the vanguard, came together in immediate terms with these acutely felt needs of the masses. Not that they were identical in the sense that the one and the other were the same thing. That, in other words, that not that everybody who was for these felt these acutely felt these immediate demands also fully supported the communist program, but they came together in the sense that only the communists, proceeding from their overall strategic program, not from something narrower, but proceeding from their overall strategic program and viewpoint, only the communists on that basis and proceeding in that way had a way to achieve these immediately and acutely felt needs of the masses. It was in that sense that they came together very immediately, not in the sense that they became identical in a linear sense. In other words, that they became one and the same thing, that everybody, in other words, became a communist because the communists had an answer to their immediate needs. But they followed the communists because every other force that offered a way out was shown in the circumstances and in relation to the communist program and in contrast with the communist program was shown not to really have a way out, not to be able to address those acutely felt needs of the masses. This is what happens in any revolutionary situations. Things become tightened up around the communists. The acutely felt needs of the masses get brought together with what the communists are putting forward at the moment, proceeding not from just the moment, but proceeding from their strategic viewpoint and strategic program. That's the sense in which these things come together. And you're working all the time to get to that point. You can't have some sort of, you know, romantic notion that you're going to win over everybody. We have to win over as many people as we can to communism at every point along the way. Don't let me be misunderstood here. There are far, 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 go on with as many fars as you want, too few communists in the world. And for a long time that will be the case, and we need to be winning as many people to communism on the correct basis and in the fullest sense as we possibly can. But we also have to, if we're materialists, we understand that most people, including most who will gravitate to us along the way and in a much bigger and in a much more concentrated way at the decisive hour, will not yet be communists. Certainly not in any full sense. And that's a contradiction we carry with us through the seizure of power and into the new society. But the point of this parachute analogy or metaphor is that when you get to the new society, that parachute is going to open back out again. Those differences that people have with you over a number of questions are going to reassert themselves. The influences of the ways of thinking of the old society and the influences of the relations, both economic and social and political, that you haven't yet transformed, those influences will reassert themselves. People will say, well, I was with you yesterday. I like some of your ideas. But now that we've gotten rid of that, why can't we go about it this way instead of the way you want to do it? We have to understand this is part of the process. It's all part of the experience, to quote that Chevy Chase movie. You know, Christmas Vacation, they're out cutting down a tree. And, you know, at one point, you know, the mother, Ellen, says that, the Chevy Chase character, Clark, you know, the daughter is frozen up to her waist. And Chevy Chase, they're out in the snow cutting down a tree, and Chevy Chase says, it's all part of the experience. Well, this is all part of our experience in a more serious way. People are going to say these things. You know, people who are tightly with you are then going to, you know, there are differences that haven't yet been overcome and resolved. And some ways in which they're going to have more of a correct understanding of some things than we are going to assert themselves. The parachute is going to open back up. There's going to be not everything tightened up around the vanguard, but things, much more diversity asserting itself. And that's what we have to work with. And if you think that you have to take all that and slam it back together again, now that you're in the new, what's the matter with you? We're in the new society now. Why are you thinking then in that old way? Yes, we have to struggle with people. You know, that was one of the great things that came out. You know, in talking about Mobile Shaw, you know. But you're just thinking in that old system way. Well, we do have to struggle with people that way all the time. But we have to understand the dialectics of this. They are going to keep thinking in that old system way even while we're struggling with them, and we'll win some over, but then they're going to be, it's going to be a longer-term process and the transformation of all these things that are captured by the four alls before you get to a whole different stage. And then you'll have other kinds of differences that'll develop But everybody will be looking at it from a whole different framework when you get to communism. Then the differences will not disappear. They'll just take on a different form. That's the way life is. Life is full of contradiction, and it's full of necessity and the transformation of necessity. And people argue about how to transform necessity or even what the hell it is. That will never stop being true. This is part of the process of making revolution to seize power. It's part of what goes on through the socialist transition, and in a whole different way, in a whole different world, to be part of what communism is all about. But if you're going to lead all this, like I said, you have to have a broad vista, and you have to have, metaphorically speaking, very broad arms to be able to encompass all this. And if you try to smash it all together the way, more in the way it was when you came right to the crunch time of seizing power, you're going to make terrible mistakes and even commit terrible crimes. Because you have to work your way through the four alls, through a whole historical epic, and not just in one country, but on a worldwide level. And a lot of people are going to want to go in a lot of different directions and try out a lot of different things. And part of the vision we and the program and the approach we have to have to socialist society is to understand how to comprehend all that, how to encompass, how, if you want to put it that way, with your broad arms, how to embrace all that and keep it all going in an overall sense where it needs to go, without suffocating people and smashing them down into, you know, into pulverized atoms along the way. How do you correctly, in other words, handle that solid core with a lot of elasticity? How do you have that core that's committed to the whole thing, to getting to communism, but at the same time understands you have to have a lot of things going in a lot of directions and a lot of contention over a lot of things in order to get there? And how do you continually, if you want to put it that way, sift through and get the right synthesis out of all this diversity and then once again have all kinds of craziness going on? All in the midst of when your enemies are seeking to jump down your throat for every fucking mistake you make and even many things that aren't mistakes. This is what makes it hard. This is why I keep invoking the metaphor of going right up to the brink of being drawn and quartered. If you're afraid of going up to the brink, you won't make it. If you think you have to keep everything tightly in formation, everybody marching in single file, all in unison about everything, all thinking exactly the same way, all uniform, you're not going to make it. It's like that, you know, Richard Pryor talking about guy lying down on the side of the road, apparently suffering from some sickness or heart attack. And, you know, Richard Pryor looking down at him debating whether he should give him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. And he said, well, I don't know about that. You know, death could jump off into you while you're trying to do that. And so he looked down and say, I don't think you're going to make it. Well, we're not going to make it, you know, with that kind of a narrow approach. You know, either motivated by revenge or just a very simplistic notion that everybody ought to be in agreement about everything. Because after all, when we were in fighting together in the trenches, so to speak, we were all tight. Well, things are going to open back up again, and then they're going to come closer, and then they're going to open up again, and they're going to come closer, and they're going to open up again. That's the way it's going to go. And this is how we have to understand and work through this and embrace it without suffocating and crushing it. That's where the real application of dialectics and materialism has to come in. How do you embrace it and in a general sense keep it moving forward in the direction it needs to go? That's the solid core. But how do you work through all the diversity of that? All the initiative that people take that you should want to encourage, all the dissent, all the wrangling over things, all the contrary views, all the people saying, well, I just want to go off and do my own thing. Well, one of the things about going off and do your own thing is you run up against necessity. And then after a while, you have to say, well, how's that working out for you now? Because somehow you have to live. You know, under capitalism, you have to live, so you have to work for capitalists in one form or another. And you have to be in some capacity contributing to the accumulation of capital, whatever you're doing. And it may be indirect, but in an overall sense, it's within that framework. Well, in socialism, you have to be contributing to the advance to communism in one form or another, but there are a lot of different ways that can happen, and it even can happen by raising disagreements with what's going on. But you still have to be part of the process. We're still dealing with necessity. It's not fair, if you want to put it that way, for you to demand that everybody else do the work so that you can eat. If you do that, then you're just trying to take back things back to where you have a class of parasites ruling over others. So you got to do your contribution. In some way or another, you got to work if you want to eat. And then if you want to go off and do some of your own things, well, that's part of the process. But you also, after a while, get lonely doing that. Everybody goes off by themselves. Almost everybody comes back. Sooner or later, people are, you know, even human individuality is socially conditioned and determined. So sooner or later, you're going to want to interrelate with other people. We don't have to run after everybody and drag them back every time they want to have a little solitude. We shouldn't be afraid of that, but we have to keep it all going in a certain way, and we have to insist on certain things. Socialism and the advance to communism means you can't live off other people. We're moving to abolish that. If you don't put in your part, you can't expect to get back your share, quote unquote. We want to move to a whole different thing where it's each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. But there's a relationship there between contributing and then drawing from society. Which doesn't mean, again, everybody has to march tightly in formation. Or there's no room for people to go off and do their own thing in certain ways. That was the example I was giving. On the one hand, like in the experience of the Cultural Revolution, there were some very positive things. There was a certain positive, solid core, but you can't and shouldn't try to produce all art in that way, as great as that was. And there were unprecedented things. Has anybody, if you've seen those ballets, for example, besides the political and ideological content, just on the level of the art and on the level of technique, has anybody ever seen people, in particular women, do things like that in ballet anywhere in the world before? But everything can't be done that way. You have to allow for people to go off and find their own ways of expressing what they think is important to express, and then you have to sift through that in an overall process without suffocating and jumping on it at every point. You have to sift through it and see what there is to be learned from. It isn't finding its place in the marketplace any longer. You're moving away from that. But still, there is a process by which, if you want to share your art or your ideas with other people are going to respond accordingly. They're going to embrace them or not embrace them according to whether or not they think they have value, not in a monetary or commodity sense, but whether they embody truth, whether they embody beauty, whether they inspire people to think about things in a way that's different and in a way that does inspire them. That's still going to be true. As Mao said, 10,000 years from now, people will still say, that stinks. And maybe they'll be wrong. And you'll have to struggle it through. A lot of times that happens. You know, new things come into being. You know, you go back to Bob Dylan. When he went electric, everybody booed him. You know, they're shouting him, that's not you, Bobby. You know, but, you know, he kept persisting. And all there were limitations to what he was doing. There were many positive things about it, including by making that change. So these things will get struggled out. But how do you keep it all going forward with a very broad embrace and with a solid core, but with one that allows for all this elasticity, for a contesting of views, for a lot of different things being in the game? You know, every game gets improved, using game metaphorically as well as literally, every game gets improved by people going against the conventions of the game. When I talk about basketball at another time, I'll give some examples of that. Every game gets improved by people going against the conventions. A lot of times, what people do going against the conventions is no fucking good. And it ends up getting rejected for good reasons. But a lot of times it's declared to be no good, but people persist and then it's seen to be good. Every new innovation, every truth, in fact, that's recognized in the world that wasn't previously recognized, generally goes through this process. Being ridiculed in one form or another, not only having ridicule heaped upon it, but having attempts to suppress it and then being recognized. And then becoming, oh, common sense. And then you're on to the next thing. So this is part of the process. And you never get there with a narrow, reductionist view that, you know, the more you are related to large-scale production, or even the poorer you are, the more automatically you represent the new society that needs to be brought into being. This is a question of a scientific approach to revolution that does represent in broad terms the outlook and interests of a class, the proletariat, but does not reside in individual proletarians or oppressed masses of people spontaneously. Making revolution is a conscious act. And the mass of people are fully grasping this, and it's our responsibility, those who do begin to get a basic grasp of this, to first of all continue to develop our grasp and struggle and wrangle with each other to do that, and second of all, take this to broader mass of people and engage them and then struggle with them and listen to them and learn from them, but also fight with them in the best and correct and sweeping sense about how to understand reality and why is it the way it is and how can it be changed and what should we do to bring that about. This kind of Leninist approach and emphasis on consciousness is not something contrary to all the attacks on it. It is exactly the opposite of what these attacks say. It is not a view that the masses are too stupid to grasp this and only an elite vanguard can rule and act in their name and in their interest. It is, on the contrary, an understanding that the masses of people are perfectly capable of grasping this, but they're not going to grasp it all at once, and they're not going to grasp it in their large majority within the confines and the workings of this system, that we need a revolution in which a vanguard leads broader masses to make that revolution more or less as those broader masses are, with all their contradictory understanding of things. And then, in all the ways I've been talking about, we go to work together with the masses to transform both circumstances and people and their thinking to achieve the four alls. And that's the way we have to conceive of, and that's the way we have to carry out this process together with the masses. Identifying key arenas of political struggle and engaging them over key arenas of ideological struggle. What does ideological mean? How you see the world and why you think things are the way they are. What are the forces that determine and drive how things are, and how could things change, or can they change? And if so, by what means? And by what methods, and through the mobilization of what factors and what forces? That's what ideology means. How do you see the broad world, and therefore how do you think you ought to live? To put it in simple terms, how do you understand the world, and how therefore do you think you ought to live? When you talk about ideology, that's what we're talking about. But when we get past the seizure of power, now here, now there, wherever this happens, and we have to be working to accelerate this everywhere in the world and tense to seizing on any openings and supporting politically people anywhere where such an opening occurs in order to make this first great leap. But as we do so, returning again to this metaphor, the parachute opens back out. As I put it in the basis, the goals, and the methods of the Communist Revolution, all the diversity of political programs, outlooks, inclinations, and so on, which reflect once again the actual remaining production and social relations that are characteristic of the old society, as well as what's newly emerging in the society that is brought into being as a result of the revolutionary seizure and consolidation of power, all these things assert or reassert themselves. This is what it means to say the parachute opens back out. People who were tightly grouped around you, there's more space now. There's more, you know, there are more differences get openly expressed and get openly seen. And as I said there, if you go on the assumption that because people all rallied to you at the particular moment when only your program could break through, if you identify that with the notion that they're all going to be marching in lockstep with you and in agreement with you at every point all the way to communism, you are going to make very serious errors. This is a very important point in general in terms of revolution. and obviously would have particular and important application in a country like the U.S. So I've spoken to how this relates to the whole concept and application of solid core with a lot of elasticity. If you let go of that solid core, then you lose everything. If you let spontaneity and all the ways in which people are still influenced by the old relations and even what exists in the new society that you've only begun to address and transform, then it will inevitably lead back to capitalism on its own inertia, so to speak, by its own momentum, but also because this is not existing in a vacuum. You've still got the representatives of the old ruling class. You've still got people who still view things in terms of it and even are determined to fight for the way things were before. And you've still got all the remaining imperialists and other reactionary forces and states in the world that are ready to jump down your throat. So if you just let it all go, there's no question where it will all go. It'll all go back to the old horrors. And then you don't get to wake up the next morning and rewind and do it over again. Revolutionary opportunities don't come along all the time. And if you go through everything that has to be gone through to make a revolution, and you get the foundation from which to carry forward to achieve these four alls, and then you just let it go, you've committed a horrible crime. Whether or not you understand it, or whether or not masses of people understand it, you've opened the floodgates to all the horrors that you've just leapt beyond, that they've just fought and sacrificed to fight their way out of. And on top of that, our enemies, and you can see this repeatedly in experience, even on a small scale. You rise up against them in any serious way, let alone overthrow them. And they get the chance to, they are going to make you pay many times over for daring to do so, so that you and others like you will never, ever think of doing so again. You remember the movie The Longest Yard? Recently came out again with Burt Reynolds, which I like that version better, but nonetheless, came out again with Adam Sandler. And in the Burt Reynolds version, it's even sharper. They're playing the guards. The prisoners are playing the guards in a football game, and they're doing pretty well. And the warden has organized this whole thing because he wants to demoralize the prisoners, as well as giving his guards a good practice game because they're in some semi-pro league. He wants to demoralize the prisoners by raising their expectations and then having them smash. But he's got this former professional football player, played by Burt Reynolds in the original version, who's quarterbacking this team, and they're actually doing pretty well. So at halftime, the warden calls Burt Reynolds over, and he says, "What the hell are you doing?" He said, "I'm giving you a football game." And then the warden tells him in no uncertain terms, "You will lose. You will throw this game, and you will lose badly. And Burt Reynolds, and if you don't, you'll be here for the rest of your life." And Burt Reynolds says, "What do you mean? I'm just doing a 3-year bid here." And he says, "Yeah, well, by the time we're through with you, it'll be a lifetime." So then Burt Reynolds says, "Okay, I agree on one condition. None of the players on my team gets injured." And the warden agrees. And then the second half starts, and Burt Reynolds is throwing the game. And one after the other, as instructed by the warden, the guards go out and break the bones of all these inmates on the other team. Now, this captures very well the view of the bourgeoisie and reactionaries in general toward what we're setting out to do. They will not only set out to defeat us, they will set out to break our bones forever having thought of challenging them in any serious way. And history is full of examples of this, even when people rise up short of revolution. And especially where they've done so and then they lose their grip on the revolution through a combination of factors. So if we just let it go, that is what we are inviting and what we will inevitably bring about for the masses of people, not just for ourselves. On the other hand, as I've said, if we don't allow for and encourage and give expression to all that elasticity, if we think we're still in a situation where the parachute is tightly wound around us, we're going to end up back in the same place with the same consequences and with people hating us in their masses. This is not what you promised us. We believed in you, and you gave us something very different than what you said, and that's going to be very hard. not to give them something different than what we're promising. And it can be done, but it can only be done with the most scientific approach. Applying that solid core with elasticity and looking at this broad sweep and looking at the same time at the underlying dynamics and being able to handle all these contradictions. And we have to keep working to develop, all of us. This is hard work. There's nobody for whom this isn't extremely hard work. Why are we doing it? Because if you get the basic scientific understanding of this, you see both the possibility and also the necessity of this in terms of what human beings are going through and what humanity could in fact be experiencing on a whole different framework. You see the necessity and you see the possibility, so you do the work. You're not going to do the work if you don't see the necessity and the possibility, and you're not going to persevere in the work if you not only continue to deepen your ability to grasp those things, but if you take up the methodology that enables you to struggle together with others to work your way, to use that phrase, to work your way through these contradictions. So this is not about the last shall be first and the first shall be last. This is not just about turning the thing upside down literally. It's about radical transformation of all of society and of the whole world. It's not about, this is a workers' party. This is not about reification or identity politics and, you know, I've been oppressed so I'm right automatically. This is not about individuals among the oppressed getting what's due to them. This is about a whole new and different world in which people as individuals and in their relation with each other approach things in a radically different way without the whole mountain of this oppression on them. To get at this from another angle, the following from a talk I gave a couple of years ago is extremely relevant. In that talk I said, Mao said that when Zhou Enlai was in the Soviet Union in the 1950s, Mao said to Zhou Enlai, another leader of the Chinese Communist Party at that time, said, I told Zhou Enlai to tell the Soviets, I'm paraphrasing, but this is the essence, Mao said, I told Zhou Enlai to tell the Soviets, what's the big deal about what you've done? All you've done is produce so many tons of steel and so many tons of grain. What's the big deal about that? You see, because the Soviets were lording it over the Chinese and other people in the international communist movement because they'd built this big, powerful socialist state with a lot of industrialization. And this bourgeois outlook had taken hold, viewing this as capital, even in relation to other communists and other communist movements and struggles. So Mao said, I told Zhou Enlai, go tell him, what's the big deal about this grain and steel you produced? And in the same spirit, I say, what's the big deal about the proletariat? Well, there is a big deal about the proletariat, but only understood in the correct sense. To make a big deal out of the proletariat in an incorrect sense is the essence of economism and all the other vulgar materialist and reformist tendencies I've been speaking to. And I went on to say in that talk that I've been rereading this book by Sebastian Haffner about the attempted revolution in Germany after World War I called Failure of a Revolution. In reading this now, I was thinking about the criticism raised against Lenin over the fact that after they seized power, the character of the Soviets, the workers' councils, changed, how they were in effect subordinated to other structures of the state. And I was saying to myself as I was reading this book and thinking on this experience, you can't run a society with workers' councils. You can't have the dictatorship of the proletariat made up of workers' councils. It's much more complex than that. The proletariat, as I've said in the discussion on epistemology, is a class that has a certain historical role. You are sitting there and you look at the sweep of history and a certain class comes forward at a certain time and it has both the necessity as a class and the ability and potential to take society to a whole different place. That is the way in which the proletariat is important and not in any other way. Someone was commenting that it's the dictatorship of the proletariat, not the dictatorship of proletarians. And right there is a big difference. It's the dictatorship of a class with all that that means in terms of its role in advancing to the achievement of the four alls and the emancipation of humanity, not the dictatorship of individual proletarians getting theirs. So in this light, I want to talk a bit about what is to be done and what is not to be done. Now, I've already spoken quite a bit to Lenin's emphasis on the importance and role of consciousness. Lenin captured this in a slogan when he said the ideal of a communist, if you will, or the essence of what a communist should be about, is not a trade union secretary fighting for reforms within the capitalist system, but a tribune of the people, revealing for the people the possibility and necessity of revolution to bring into being a whole different world. I'm paraphrasing, but that's the essence. Not a trade union secretary, but a tribune of the people, said Lenin. And he went on to explain that this means enabling the masses of people, proletarians in particular, but others as well in different strata in society, to have a materialist understanding, or as Lenin said it, to make a materialist estimate of all significant events in society and the world, and a materialist estimate of the response of all different strata and groups in society to those events. Why do the students, generally and broadly speaking, without being vulgar, respond in certain ways to certain things? Why do shopkeepers act the way that shopkeepers act? Why do people who have a better paying job tend to look at the things this way? Why do people who are in the lower, deeper sections of the proletariat tend to spontaneously look at things a different way? Without being vulgar and reductionist, this has to do with people's role and place in the overall process of the functioning of society as determined and driven forward by the production relations and the accumulation process of capitalism, but also is influenced by all the social relations and superstructural factors of politics and culture and ideas and philosophy and so on. The point of all this is to enable, in particular, the proletarians to see how, in broad sweeping terms, not in narrow and reductionist terms, not in vulgar materialist terms, but in dialectical materialist terms, to see why and how different classes and strata and groups in society respond to major events the way they do. Why do broad sections of even the educated classes act so foolishly in relation to bourgeois politics? Why do they have such a hard time understanding what the essence of these politics is, even after you tell them over and over again, and if they don't listen to you, even after the bourgeoisie insists on teaching them over and over again? Why do they have such a hard time coming to grips with this? Because of their social position, and because for the implications for them of coming to grips with this, which are different than the implications for someone living in the inner city, barely able to survive on some chump-ass job. For that person, in that situation, to come to a realization that this is a dictatorship and what the implications of that are is very different than for someone who leads a more privileged existence. That doesn't mean we're writing off the latter. Well, the point of this, and Lenin's point, is to enable the proletariat to see two things and their dialectical relation to each other. One, why only the proletariat as a class, not as individuals, but as a class, has the interest and the ability to lead and be the backbone of a fight to abolish all this. And two, how it's possible, why it's possible, and in what ways it's possible to unite with and lead all these other strata, and what their limitations are and what contradictions you have to deal with in doing so. This is essential, as Lenin pointed out, in order for the proletariat to develop its full consciousness as a class of its own position in society in relation to the existing system, of its potential to overthrow and abolish the system and all the relations and ideas bound up with it, and of the necessity as well as the possibility of working to unite while leading a broad array of other forces. So this is what it means to be a tribune of the people, and it means also, as Lenin said, to set before all, without apology or hesitancy, but very boldly our communist convictions, to explain to people why we stand for what we stand for, why we're working for what we're working for, what is the problem, what is the solution, and why other avenues do not provide a solution, do not get to the problem, cannot deal with what people themselves hate and want to see eliminated, and what they would aspire to and like to see brought into being. So another way to say this is a crucial part of enabling growing numbers of proletarians to develop revolutionary communist consciousness and to see both the necessity and possibility of building a united front to achieve the revolutionary objectives, but a united front under the leadership of the proletariat as embodied in its world outlook and its strategic interests in achieving the four alls. So it means taking to the masses, first of all, the masses of the lower, deeper sections of the proletariat and other basic masses as well, but also among all strata of people, taking to them boldly revolution, communism, taking it to them not only boldly, but with persistence and perseverance. That was another thing about Mobile. Here you come again, you got to hear about this communism once again. Why? Because he just couldn't let go of it? No, because this is what we need to get out of all this. This is what we need to have a whole different world, not only for us, but for humanity. So we have to be persistent and persevering. Why? Because we have a better good to sell? Because our commodity should be able to find a better place in the market? No, but because everything else is not an answer to the problems that are vexing and weighing on and tormenting and torturing the masses of people, particularly at the base of society, but among all strata of people. Why do we have to have a society in which it's calculated that 1/4 to 1/3 of all women will be sexually assaulted during their lifetimes? Why do we have to live in a society like that? We do not. Why do we not? Why do we have to live in a society where people can be worked until they can work no longer and then thrown out like useless garbage all over the world? Why do we have to have a world where little children's life is, as I said, I'm thinking it's on the DVD, is over before it begins? Why do they have to be consigned to that fate? Why do you have to be mocked at every turn, everywhere you go, and made to feel like an alien and dangerous because you're trying to make your way through life and trying to be able to live? Why do you have to be insulted and called names just because you dare to hold your head up and have some pride about walking through the world? Why do you have to be called a spick or a nigger or all this other shit? Why does the world have to be like this? It does not. And this is why we have to be persistent and persevering, not because this is our thing, but because the world is like this, but does not have to be like this, and should not be like this. And we could go on and on. I'm barely touching the surface of this. And it's hard. I'm not just saying this rhetorically. It's hard to find the words to adequately describe these real horrors. But people experience them every day. They know what we're talking about. But they think this is the way the world has to be. They think God ordained it this way. Or this is your trial in this life in order to get a better life in the future. Or that people are just all fucked up. Or that we're all fucked up. Whatever group you identify with. Or that men are just naturally that way, or women are just naturally that way. Or even that white people are just naturally that way. I understand why Elijah Muhammad and all them called them devils. But that's not scientific. If you look at the history of the U.S., there's a lot of acting like devils, quote unquote, on the part of white people. But that's not scientific. And there's a lot of contrary experience, too. A lot of struggle and sacrifice on people's part for better things and a better world. But let's be scientific. What is really going on here? Why is the world this way? And if it just had to be this way, then I guess we'd have to make our peace with it and find the best we could have within it, which is what a lot of people do. In fact, what most people do until and unless they learn that it doesn't have to be this way, and especially those who are suffering terribly under it, once they begin to understand why it's the way it is and that it doesn't have to be this way, we'll gravitate to that, but we have to keep coming back to it. I don't want to hear that old communist shit. Well, who hasn't run into that many times over? This is all part of the experience. It's what we have to work our way through. Because why? Because, you know, it's like in that movie where you have to wear certain glasses to see these beasts around with blood dripping down. Because we put on those glasses and we see the world the way it actually is, although we have to keep learning more and more deeply. Partly because we don't know everything and never will know everything, and partly tied in with that, the world's always changing. But we made a big leap. We see the world the way it is, and other people don't see it. So that's a big difference. And you have to keep going back and struggling and persevering boldly and with science. You have to keep digging down and getting the science. People raise questions you can't answer, go back to the science. Wrangle collectively with people. Figure out the answer and go back to them. Don't be afraid to say, I don't know. You can't say it every time or you might as well give up. But everybody has to say, I don't know about something sometimes. There's nothing to be afraid of in that. You go back and you find out. You go where you have to go and you wrangle with whom you have to wrangle with to find out. And then you go back to people and say, here's the answer to what you raised, and you engage them. And that will move people too, because you took them seriously and because you had something to say about it when you got around to it. So anyway, I don't want to go too much into the specifics, but I'm speaking to an orientation. We have to persevere and do this boldly and with science, persist boldly and with science, because the world is a horror and it doesn't have to be. And there is a way out of this. We've reached the threshold in the development of human society where we can make that rupture and leap through a whole historical process of struggle and transformation. And the era we're talking about, the era of communism, is a whole different era, where, as Mao put it, communism embodies humanity struggling with each other to consciously and voluntarily transform itself and the objective world. Without the fetters and impediments, without the shackles, without the obstacles of a division of society into antagonistic social groups and classes and the corresponding ideas that get in the way of being able to correctly engage and understand reality and determine how to change it in the interests of the great majority of society and ultimately all of humanity. It's not that under communism there'll be perfect knowledge. It's not even that under communism social relations won't pose an impediment to understanding and changing reality. They constantly will. Communism is not a utopia. Communism is a new set of contradictions. And you have to struggle your way through them. And under communism, old social relations will become outmoded. They'll become obstacles. They'll have to be transformed. But it won't take the form of some lording it over and enslaving others and antagonistic relationships developing on that basis. It'll take the form of people struggling over what is, in fact, old and outdated and needs to be moved aside and changed or eliminated altogether, and what is new and represents the way forward. But the what won't be there is the division of society and of humanity into antagonistic social groups and classes with all the corresponding social relations and ideas which in a whole other way get in the way of really engaging and understanding and changing reality. So when we talk about consciously and voluntarily changing humanity, changing itself in the objective world, this doesn't mean some utopian idea that there'll be no contradiction, there'll no longer be any ignorance, everybody will understand everything perfectly and agree on everything. God, that would be boring. But it means that you'll be in a whole different place in terms of that process. It means that people will understand in a whole different way, on a whole different foundation, in a qualitatively different and scientific sense, what is moving and shaping the development of things in nature and society, and how should human beings approach how they want to live in relationship to that. And then you have struggle. Because everybody will not and should not agree on everything. But they'll have enough fundamental agreement and enough fundamental underlying material foundation to be able to work these things through without forming rival cliques and gangs and factions to kill each other or to do injury and harm to each other, even emotionally in the way that people do now, let alone physically. I'm not saying nobody's feelings will ever get hurt, but that's a different matter. And what happens now, and the implications of that. So this is a whole different world we're talking about, and this is the way the world is not only should be and can be, but is already tending. It is already moving in that direction, straining against the ways in which these four alls are holding it back from getting there. And our responsibility, our role is to understand that more and more deeply and to enable broader numbers of people to understand that as we unite with them, whatever their level of understanding is, in struggling against the key ways in which the oppression of the system is concentrated against the masses of the people at any given time, such as driving out the Bush regime, to cite one key example. So that is what is to be done. And an important point to stress in this is its opposite. What is not to be done? What is not to be done is simply to go for revenge or for oneself. What is not to be done is to fall into adopting means that in a fundamental sense are an antagonism with the ends, the objectives that we're striving for. We're always accused, the communists, of believing that the ends justify the means. Oh, well, you know, when you make an omelet, you have to break eggs. You want a better world, you have to trample on people to get there. So what? That's not what we believe. I'm not saying no communist has ever acted like that or that that's never been a phenomenon in socialist society where that's exerted an influence, even a significant one. But that's not what we're all about. And that's not how we must proceed. There has to be a fundamental unity between our means and our ends. Now, this is another contradiction. See, it's not linear. It's not straight line. It's not all flat and easy. For example, we're for the abolition of states. But we first have to have a good state in order to get to the abolition of states. We have to have the dictatorship of the proletariat. We have to get rid of a very bad state, the bourgeois state, to put it in simple terms, and get a good state, the proletarian state, the socialist state, in order to be able to work through the contradictions that can enable us to abolish a state without having the bourgeois state be reinstituted. So you can see there's a contradiction there, but we cannot use means in achieving that end. We cannot use means in, first of all, seizing power and then advancing through the dictatorship of the proletariat to the abolition of the dictatorship of the proletariat. In doing all that, we can't use means that are in basic conflict and antagonism with those ends. We cannot, for example, try to do this by having a small group put guns to the heads of everybody else and forcing them to accept the dictates the way we're always accused of doing. For two reasons. One, because it isn't in conformity with and it won't lead to where we want to go in the kind of society and world we want to have anyway. And bound up with that, it won't lead to the results that it's supposedly seeking to achieve anyway. Even if you could enforce that for a while, what you would be enforcing would not be a new and radically different kind of state. It'd be the old state in rather acute form, and it would bring back all the old relations. Or other people would overthrow you because they get sick of it, and there's always somebody out there in the world who might be more powerful than you. And if you seek to impose your will in that kind of antagonistic way by force and violence over the mass of people, or even over a section of people that you should, in strategic terms, be uniting with, like the middle strata, you will drive them into the arms of somebody else who will be more powerful than you. Because for a long time we're going to be in a world with more powerful forces, if you want to just look at it in kind of narrow terms. Imperialists who have bigger and more powerful weapons than we do. And without the masses of people, we have no means to stand up to them. And why should the masses of people rally to that if they're being treated in that kind of a way? If what we're embodying and, in fact, enforcing is not worth fighting for, why should they fight for it? And as soon as they get the opportunity not to fight for it or even to fight against it, that's what they'll do. So on both levels, it's not what we're aiming for, and it won't achieve what we even declare we're aiming for anyway. So we can't have means that are in fundamental conflict with our aims, with our ends. Everything we do has to be guided by, and in a fundamental sense, be consistent with an expression of where we're going in the largest and longest term sense. Lenin used the example of compromises and compromises. Sometimes you have to make compromises with imperialist states when they're more powerful than you. But you can't make compromises of fundamental principle. And he used this analogy. He said, if you're going on the highway and you're held up by a group of robbers, and they demand you turn over your money, that's one thing. Under a lot of circumstances, that'd be the sensible thing to do. But if you decide to join them and start robbing other people, that's a whole other thing. One is a tactical compromise which doesn't compromise principle. The other is a strategic compromise which affects the whole nature of what you are and what you're doing and does compromise essential principles. So we can make compromises, but we can't compromise essential and fundamental principles. There cannot be a fundamental and essential disconnect, as they say, between what we're doing at any given time and the nature and character of that and where it all needs to go. They have to be in fundamental unity, even with all the contradictions that are involved in that. So what is not to be done is accepting the terms and confines of the system and contributing to a situation in which the masses remain trapped within the system with all the horrific consequences of that. Revenge, or they had a chance, now let me have my go at it, is just a form of doing that. Whatever anybody intends, that's what it leads to and comes down to. Either it leads to either never making a revolution, or having that revolution turned around and things taken back into the old society. If things are guided and motivated by the desire and vision, in one form or another, of seeking revenge and the notion of leaving intact the basic relations but simply changing those who have risen to the top within those same relations. And in opposition to that, what we have to bring forward, what we have to embody ourselves, but more than that, bring forward wave after wave of masses of people to embody, even as we're uniting with them in struggle before they get there, but constantly working and struggling with them to bring them forward to be nothing less than the emancipators of all humanity. To be fighters not just against one particular form of oppression or another, especially those that most directly affect them, but to be fighters to abolish all forms of oppression, to achieve those four alls, to move humanity to the point where it's moved beyond the narrow horizon of bourgeois right and all the horrors that are bound up with being limited within those confines and chained within those confines. This is the fullest meaning of what we have to be about. This is the fullest meaning of being a communist. This is the fullest meaning of being the emancipators of humanity. Sure, I mentioned an important and valuable book. It's called Left Out, Pragmatism, Exceptionalism, and the Poverty of American Marxism, 1890 to 1922 by Brian Lloyd, L-L-O-Y-D. This book provides many important insights into why before our party, a Leninist vanguard never really developed in the U.S. Leninist not just or essentially in the organizational sense, but above all in the ideological what-is-to-be-done-est sense. And this book is also very relevant to a number of the key themes in Communism, A Whole New World, and the Emancipation of All Humanity, Not the Last Shall Be First, and the First Shall Be Last.